Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Hello, hello, hello. Morning, everybody. Welcome to this session of the Sydney Writers' Festival. My name is Jason Steger. I edit the books pages in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it is a great pleasure to be here. Before we begin the proceedings, I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to pay my respects to their elders past and present and future. David and I will be talking for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, after which there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions, so do please have a think during the moments leading up to that. And David will be happy to sign copies of his books outside in the bookshop afterwards. If you've got a telephone on you and it's not switched off, please do turn it off now. Have you turned yours off?
I don't, but I don't have a SIM card here. No one calls me anyway.
So. Oh, that's all right.
Yeah, it's impossible that anything could happen.
So David has published 7 works of fiction and 2 memoirs in English. Apparently, he has something of a queue of novels yet to be published. Much of his writing has been about the sea and boats, be it in his memoir, A Mile Down, or his previous novel, Bright Air Black. But most of his writing, it has to be said, has been taken up by suicide as its subject. And suicide has loomed large in his own life. His latest book, Halibut on the Moon, also deals with suicide, but in my reading, it's a very different work from his other books. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome David Vann. David, I think you should possibly tell everybody about your father, because it was your father's suicide that has informed much of your work and has impacted on your own life. Could you tell us about him and his death?
Sure. First, I just want to thank you for coming and really thank the festival for having me back here. I was here in 2010 or 11, and it was my favorite festival in years that I've been to. And I love Sydney. I've been here half a dozen times, so just thrilled to be back. And wanted to say thank you to Michaela and Tam and everyone else who's done a lot of hard work putting the festival together. And I wanted to thank Jason, too, who's been super generous to me. And I was on the TV show with him a couple of times with Jen, who I love also, and went hiking the Lara Pinta Trail with and such. So just wanted to say my thank yous first. And then, my dad. I wrote Legend of a Suicide, my first book of fiction about him, and then 20 years later ended up writing this book, Halibut on the Moon. Didn't expect to write about him again, but was kind of surprised by something, and we can talk about that later, the genesis for it. But my father basically is a shifting target. He's seemed differently to me and meant different things at different times. One thing about suicide bereavement is that it's a very long, extended conversation with no one, and that conversation shifts over time. So at first, at 13, it was just such a sudden loss and unbelievable. I didn't see it coming at all. And he'd been a really wonderful father, a really loving, wonderful father. He spent all his vacations with me and my sister. He was in Alaska, and I was living with my sister and mother in California, but I spent 4 months a year with him, all summer, Christmas, Easter, all the times that were possible I spent with him, and he always made it clear he loved us, and we had to do a lot of hunting and fishing because that's what he loved doing, but that was great. We saw these beautiful places in Alaska and Northern California. And he would wrestle us like down on the carpet, and we're, you know, laughing and being tickled and stuff, and you know, very warm and present, but not so good as a husband. You know, broke up 2 marriages through infidelity and felt very guilty and didn't like being a dentist, although he was good at that. So he felt that he was a failure in all of his life, that he was a piece of shit. probably fueled partly by his mother's religion, her Christianity, and his feeling that he didn't, meet that. In writing about my father and in writing about a school shooter also, I wrote about a mass murderer who killed five others and himself and wounded 18. I wrote about him as a suicide primarily, not as a murderer. I couldn't make either of their suicides inevitable. I could talk about the five or six currents that led to the moment where it became possible at the end, but at the end they could have chosen not to do it. And that was interesting to me, that no matter how much time I've spent thinking about my father and writing about him, that last moment still seems essentially accidental, that it could have gone either way. And with the school shooter also, he sat in his car and waited almost too late. The class was almost out. And it seems that he had almost decided not to do it. But then in the last couple minutes possible, ended up doing it. Mm-hmm. And my father had a .44 Magnum handgun, which had a hair trigger. He only had to have a moment to do it, to think that he should do it, that would actually happen.
This book, I said that it seemed to me be different from some of your other writings, some of your other novels that have dealt with suicide. It seemed to me much more personal, much more definite, much more specific. And the other thing about it is that Jim, the father, is named. He is Jim Van, mm-hmm. and his children are Tracy and David Van. Mm-hmm. So, it by definition, you are making it much more personal, much more real, in a sense, mm-hmm. aren't you?
Yeah, it was a desperate attempt. Because the truth is that after so many years, I can't recover him. And the character on the page is fictional. It's not my father anymore. I failed, essentially. I can't bring him back, and I can't know his last moments. And the whole thing's such a giant lie. I mean, I was 13 at the time of his... The book takes place with his last visit to all the family in California before going back up to Alaska to kill himself. And I was 13 at the time, so I don't know any of the conversations he had with any of my the adults in my family at that time. I don't know what happened. I know only that he was there visiting and that he saw a therapist. And my stepmother has been really good and told me a lot over the years, all of her interactions with him. But all the rest, the conversations are all made up. And also, everyone in my family lied, always. My father was, I don't think he ever told me anything true. I mean, it was not just the size of the fish, but it was like how the divorces happened, or that he got crabs from like the locker room at the YMCA, not from like seeing a prostitute. Like, I mean, they were big lies and small lies. And I lied to him too. I would hunt squirrels, and by the time I got back home, there were six versions of how I got the squirrel, and he never got to hear the true version, you know? But my family, everyone was so upset by his suicide that afterward, driven by their guilt and their rage and their shame, they had really different versions of who he was and what happened and what it meant. And that's why my first book, Legend of a Suicide, is framed by short stories around a short novel, and they're all competing. They all have different versions. They're written in different styles, even different voices, and they have different views of who he was and what happened, because there was no one version. So this one seems like it's very close and true. I use my real name, I use my dad's real name, but that's a total lie and fake job. It was my attempt to try to get as close as possible, and it talks about all the real places. All the places are the actual ones. You can see like what my grandparents' house looks like and Lakeport, where my dad grew up. And physically, you can see what all my family looks like. All the details are true. And our family heritage, like coming from Cherokee Chiefs, for instance, and that my grandfather felt alienated from American culture and didn't talk about his Cherokee heritage. Like, all of that's true. But the character in there, moving and speaking and talking, who's supposed to be my father, is something else. And none of my family, like my grandfather, he never said anything. After my dad's suicide, he just didn't talk with anyone about it until he died. Like, that was his response. So the long, beautiful conversation he ends up having with my father in the book is something that I wanted him to have. So the book is wish fulfillment in that way. If I could push each member of my family to really talk and say the things that they're actually thinking, this is what it could have been.
So do you think you got, I mean, there's that notion, isn't there, of truth in fiction. Do you think you got a truth in halibut.
Yeah, but there's this Italian mathematician who was so funny, this festival in Milan. I was saying, like many fiction writers do, in fiction we discover truth, really. Like, you know, the more true lives, the idea is that people have all the garbage of their life, thousands of details in daily life that don't matter. But if you compress it in fiction, if you put them under pressure in scenes where they're close to someone they love and they would never want to hurt, but they are hurting them anyway because they're acting unconsciously and out of control, you know, the stuff of Greek tragedy, the stuff we do in our families. If you compress that in a short space and you put the characters under pressure until they break, they'll be revealed and we see who they really are. And that's more true to that person in their real life than any day they actually lived. There's something revealed about the nature of who they are. And I do actually believe that. I do think that's true. But this mathematician who's so brilliant and funny in Italy pointed out on stage that that's not actually truth. Math is truth. He was wonderful. I loved him.
So, but when you finished Halibut, I mean, did you think about your father differently, having attempted to get close to him in those final sort of three or four days?
I did.
Did it change how you see him?
It did. To me, I write because of what happens unconsciously or subconsciously in the writing of the books, the surprises. I write with no plan or outline, no idea what will happen in the book, although in this I had a general, I know he's in California and then goes to Alaska. But I'm looking for surprises in what the characters would do or say, how they'll view the landscape, how that reflects their interior life, what kind of self and character is discovered. And in this, there are so many moments where he was bipolar at the end. He has these kind of fantastic visions, like for halibut on the moon, for instance, NASA taking a halibut to the moon. They're kind of wonderful visions that he has.
It's brilliant. And it's a fantastic vision.
And he sinks really low at times, too. And I did feel that I got closer to him through those surprising moments, moments that I couldn't have seen coming in the writing. And I realized that, and I struggled with this book. I took twice as long to write it as any of the other books. It was hard to write. And by the end, I realized I had just so much more sympathy for my father than I'd had before. That now I'm 13 years older than he ever was. And I've failed much more in my adult life than he failed in his. Before, I was so angry at him and angry at his failures, and I was less sympathetic. And now I feel sorry for him that he didn't have more freedom. He didn't feel more freedom, more possibility for who he could be and what would be acceptable about who he could be. He came from an earlier generation. He had a much more narrow band of what could be acceptable for a self and a life and how it could be lived. So the book did change me quite a bit. It made me a little bit softer and more accepting of my own faults and failures as I became more accepting of him, because inevitably there's this mirror thing that's happened with my father. How I view him is how I view myself, essentially.
Without the ending, though, I hope.
Without what?
Without the ending, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing. Actually, Stephen Romay, who's been so wonderful and supportive of me here in Australia with lots of reviews of all my books, he sent me a note, an email after he read my book. It's like, I'm just worried about you. Are you okay? Like, you get very close to his despair at the end here. Is that, you know, something you felt? And luckily, no. I've actually never had suicidal ideation, you know, suicidal thoughts. I felt doomed for 22 years after a suicide to repeat it. I was sure that it was going to be waiting for me, that I would hit a low moment in my life and it would just hit me from behind. It'd be irresistible. And then I hit a low moment where I lost absolutely everything and it was my fault and I had nothing to look forward to and everything was bad. And after 2 or 3 days in that moment, I realized I hadn't had a single thought of suicide. It just occurred to me. And then I never worried about it again after that. I realized it just wasn't me. In my divorce, I was trying so hard to stay in a marriage where I was already gone and had been thinking about divorce every day for 3 years that I started to feel mentally ill at the end there. And both therapists were worried that I was suicidal. And even then I thought, no, I'm not suicidal. I just feel ripped in half. Like, and I am worried about my mental health now. But within 2 weeks after separating, I just felt fine again. My mind became one mind. It was no longer ripped in half. I realized my mental health was just fine. Like, so, somehow I'm wired differently. Like, yeah. I actually know for a fact, because I've seen it over and over in my life, that even if you lose everything, your life can reform, and actually your new life is better because it fits who you are now. It doesn't fit anymore kind of who you were before. So twice I've lost everything financially where I didn't have even $10 cash or credit, like absolute crash and burns. And my divorce felt like my dad had died again. It felt like a tremendous loss after 16 years together. You know, there have been some bad things, and at each moment, I knew, absolutely, I'll be fine. Because of his suicide. It was actually a gift of his suicide. It was so hard to go through that. My mother was so strong in helping us through that I understood, like, how you get through things. And I know that I can always do that.
So, I mean, on the one hand, you sometimes have talked about the impact of his suicide causing or perhaps affecting some things in your life that have gone wrong. And mm-hmm. But then you've got the ultimate lesson of his death that actually sort of stops you going there.
I've made so many mistakes and so spectacularly, I'd like to blame someone. It's good to think that he might be there lurking and it might actually be his fault. But yeah, he gave a lot of gifts too. He also sent a letter to us at the end, to me and my sister, saying that he was a dentist, he made tons of money. Like, at one point in the late 1970s, he was making $30,000 a month. In the 1970s, I mean, dentists can make a lot of money. Like, if you look in their offices, they have, like, pictures of their planes, you know? That's a sign. It's because they could charge a little less. Like, I was supposed to be third-generation dentist. But anyway, he wrote this letter to us, and he said that it turns out money meant nothing, that it didn't give him any of the things he wanted, and we should do what we want to do and not have our lives be about money. And that was wonderful because, obviously, going into writing, that was a poor career choice. You know, everyone could agree. Even my mentor, John LaRue, who just passed away very recently, even he, who was so supportive and really gave me permission to be a writer, even he said in his office, "Are you sure you don't want to go to law school?" I mean, everyone seemed to agree this was a very poor choice and it wasn't going to work out. And indeed, it didn't for so long. I worked on the first book, Legend of Suicide, from 19 years old to 29 years old, and I was published when I was 42. In the meantime, I couldn't be a professor because I'd written a book, but it needed to be published to continue on. So I worked as a lecturer for like 50 classes, which is kind of like unpaid labor. It's very close. I mean, you know, 30 students for a semester for 15 weeks for $1,200. Like, is that even being paid? For a long time, I thought, wow, everyone was right. Everyone was absolutely right.
There's a line that you give Jim in Halibut on the Moon when he says, "Maybe I loved as well as I could. Maybe this is the best me I'm offering, and that's all anyone can do." I mean, that's a pretty good... That's a pretty good assessment, isn't it?
Yeah, but the other person doesn't think that's enough.
No, I know. With Legend of a Suicide, you spent 10 years on it before stopping and then waiting.
The 10 years, I mean, again, almost everything I say and even that I think is kind of a lie. I mean, it's how I'm built. I was meant to be a fiction writer. Like, I like lies. I mean, it's sort of like my lifeblood and how I work. And I'm interested in how they work in our heads. Like, we're telling a story every day about ourselves. Like, hey, I'm David. Like, I mean, I won't try to repeat, like, whatever your story is or what mine is. But but we have a fiction that we're constantly building every day about ourselves in order to have a self, in order to have some sense of self, because the truth is there's nothing there. There's no one helping. So it's the story that, like, makes, you know, something happen. And with this, part of the legend or the story of my writing is that it took 10 years to write, and, you know, no agent would send it to publishers, and then it finally comes out to prizes in many languages, like the overlooked literary career. It's like, it's a great story. It's a great narrative to tell. And I did work on it for the 10 years, but the truth is that I was throwing everything away during the 10 years. I was learning how to write. The stories in there are each in a different style, not because I had a grand plan for the book, that it would be like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales with the debate in style and content, but because I was just learning to write, and I'd read Carver, and I'd start writing stories like him, and then I'd read Marilyn Robinson, Elizabeth Bishop, and I'd write a story like them, and, you know, because I had no kind of compass at all. So that's why they're in the different styles, actually. And I threw away almost everything from those years, and the novel, which is most of the book, I wrote half of it in 17 days, sailing from California to Hawaii. Everything I've ever published, I wrote quickly, and it's published the same as the first draft. I only do line edits. I don't, like, take out a scene or add a scene or move it around. I don't even cut or add whole paragraphs usually. So I did work on it for 10 years, but I was just learning to write.
Yeah, well,
and
that's
the part that's published was actually written really quickly and mostly right at the end.
Yeah. But in Sukhawan Island, there's a moment, I don't know, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but there's a moment which is truly shocking. About halfway through.
Yeah.
And you didn't know it was coming, did you?
Yeah, I had no idea.
That's I find that completely weird. I
mean, yeah. Yeah,
so,
and
so
I actually...
So you were right. I mean, we don't want to give spoilers, do we?
I think I should say what happens, just because...
I mean, it's an
no
extraordinary
book of literary fiction.
It's an extraordinary writing story, I think.
Yeah, I think if it's okay with you, I'd like to just say what happens in that moment because it changed everything I thought about writing. And it won't actually make sense, the description, unless I say what happens. So... anyway, in the middle of that, most of the book is a novel, and it's supposed to be writing my father's suicide. But halfway through, it's a father and son homesteading on an island in Alaska. And the reason it's that story is because my father, at the end, asked me to spend a year back in Alaska with him, and I said no. And then soon after is when he killed himself. So I felt really guilty. I felt that if I had said yes, then my father would still be alive. So writing that story, without my realizing it when I was writing, was a second chance to go back and say yes and spend the year together. Of course, I had no idea that I was doing this when I was writing it. But halfway through the story that's supposed to end with his suicide, the father has been suicidal, has had the gun to his head, but then when the boy comes in and discovers him, he just hands him the pistol and walks out. And the boy looks down at it, and at the moment that he looks down at it and sees the shells in there, and the revolver, I realize he's just going to put it to his head. And in the second half of the sentence, he just does that. And it's not something that I saw coming at all. I had no idea. I was so disturbed by it, I stopped writing. The next day, I planned to cut that and continue on with my plan. But rereading those 80 or so pages, it was a revelation. It was like they were written by a different author, like they weren't even mine. I was seeing them for the first time and understanding how much unconscious pattern there is to a text. To a fiction. And that changed my writing forever. Now I write with no plan or outline for any of the books. I know that they're going to have all the structure and pattern where the last chapter will match the first, even though I have no idea what the book is about. A book like Goat Mountain, I only started to understand it in the last 50 pages. I had no idea why the Holy Trinity was showing up in strange forms. No idea of the themes even, you know? So the way it works is that those unconscious transformations are a way that we allow ourselves to tell stories that we couldn't tell otherwise, and a way that we're trying to make ourselves whole after we've been broken. I think that's the engine behind it. So what happens is, I could never write about what my father's body would have looked like after he blew off most of his head. Like, he did it on the phone with my stepmother, and she actually heard parts of his head like dripping from the ceiling, and it was so gruesome. I just couldn't quite go there to fully imagine it. And I was in denial for a lot of years of his death. I imagined it was someone else's body, and he was still out in the tundra somewhere in Alaska, you know, maybe a spy or something. And I also couldn't write about my grief on the first day I found out his death. I tried for years. This is why it took 10 years. For years, I'd write about that day, and we're just all running around crying. It's unreadable. Like, you can't, as a reader, you can't possibly care or immerse. It's too direct, and it's too much. So when the boy kills himself instead of the father, when that shock happens, now the father discovering the boy, suddenly I could write about the body. It could become real. Suddenly I could write about the grief right after, because it was one step removed and made it possible to do. So these unconscious transformations are about how the author can find a way through a story and material and can be made whole psychologically and emotionally in some way. And so fiction is not fake in that way. These are real transformations that are like self-therapy and that really do come as shock and surprises to the author that they don't see coming. So I do think of fictions as living things. They're not planned and they're not fake. in all the books since, they've taken on their own life. You know, like Halibut on the Moon is so much funnier and lighter than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange sort of black comedy, isn't like
there? Yeah.
A lot of black comedy.
Yeah.
So Halibut started, though, with talking to your stepmother, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really... I didn't plan to write this book. I was going to put it off maybe forever. And because I'm lazy, you know, it seemed difficult. But I was on tour for Aquarium in 2015, and I met with my stepmother, as I usually do when I go to California, and she told me a new thing I didn't know, no one in my family knew, which is that she slept with my father right at the end. They met together in a hotel room on that last trip he had when everyone thought he was just seeing family. This was not good for him emotionally and psychologically because he had broken up their marriage through cheating on her several times, and she had moved on. She was going to marry someone else, but he was really heartbroken. And as people will sometimes do, and I think especially men, he focused all his despair, all of his disappointments, all his rage on her, and really made all of his despair her fault. And to be able to be with her a last time and have sex, but not really be with her in a relationship, I think was harmful for him. But I don't blame her for his suicide, especially because my whole father's family blamed her for all those decades. And she's been so strong and helpful. She's the one who's helped me understand him and write about him. And the book is actually dedicated to her. But what she told me is that she saw him this last time, and when they went into the hotel room, she picked up his toiletries bag, this little leather satchel he had, and it was really heavy, and she saw his .44 Magnum pistol was in there, and she knew immediately that it was for her. She was sure that he was going to kill her before killing himself. He had been very angry in all the things he had said and written to her. In his last suicide notes, he talks about that she shafted him and such. Like very kind of violent imagery. And she had just lost her parents to murder-suicide 11 months before, less than a year before. Her mother shot her husband with a shotgun in the living room and then killed herself with a pistol. She had actually written a suicide note, including to him, and didn't plan to kill him, but he had a big gun collection, as Americans all do. And they were really, really nice guns. I mean, you know, thousands of dollars worth of classic shotguns and stuff. So he got to have one of them at the end, and she picked one of his antique pistols to kill herself with. So anyway, this is very real and frightening for my stepmother. She really thought that she was going to be killed. So this was a new and frightening possibility for me. I'd never thought of my father killing someone else before killing himself. The shame of the suicide was enough, right? Do we really need that he might have killed someone else also? Maybe even us? Like, great. So that was a pretty disturbing thought. And it was a scene I couldn't get out of my head, that hotel room. And that was the genesis of the book. Some of my other books have been like that. Caribou Island, I was walking out across the frozen lake in Alaska, and it's a really deep lake, and it's middle of winter, very beautiful. I was alone, and I thought, I will be the first jerk to fall through this ice and die, because that's all my boating disasters, all my poor decisions. I definitely would be the first one to die. And it's like, I knew it was going to happen. So I thought, I could be careful. So I bent down, and I brushed the snow off the ice to see how thick it was. But I was surprised to see it's just black in a 600-foot deep lake. You can't tell if the ice is a couple inches thick or 10 feet thick. There's no way of telling. And I realized my character, Irene, after 30 years of marriage, could see that marriage just become nothing, that she's looking into her marriage as she looks into the ice. So I scurried back. I never even made it out to Caribou Island. I went back to the hotel, and I wrote that scene, which occurs late in the book but was the genesis of the book. So this, I think this is, as I said, the writing is about these unconscious transformations, a kind of self-therapy in a way, and an attempt to try to have vision or shift in vision. And so it makes sense that moments like that that are disturbing, that have to be dealt with in some way, could, you know, generate a whole book. The other thing was that after more than 35 years, I came to a different feeling about guilt. Everyone feels guilty after a suicide, as long as they're old enough. I've met some 8-year-olds who don't, but... as long as they're old enough, they feel guilty. There's something they could have done differently. And like my uncle was supposed to not leave my father alone. He was supposed to go up to Alaska with him, had the tickets, the plane flights, everything, and supposed to keep his guns and shells separate. But at the airport, my dad, his older brother, talked him out of it, convinced him he was fine, and then went right up and killed himself. So my uncle felt so guilty for a long time because of that. So no one should feel guilty. It's not their fault. It's the suicide's fault. Mm. They made the decision. And I really feel strongly about that. I don't want people to feel guilty afterward. But after 35 years, I came around to, yeah, but we all did fail him in the end. You know, he would have been alive longer if I'd said yes to that trip. He would have been alive longer if my uncle had gone with him to Alaska. And why is it that we weren't able to help him? Why could the entire family who loved him and wanted to help him, why were they not able to help him? Because to me, it goes right to the heart of Greek tragedy. Greek tragedy is not about enemies. It's about why do we hurt the people we love the most? And why do we fail in love? Why are we not able to help those closest to us? So the characters aren't enemies. They're very close, but they're acting unconsciously and out of control. So they end up hurting each other, even though they don't mean to. All my books are Greek tragedy because of that.
You say that at the end of Black...
Bright Air Black, yeah.
Bright Air Black, you say, the Greek tragedies. You always write Greek tragedies.
Yeah, because I live it also. I mean, I have no idea why I'm making any of the important decisions in my life. Even during the last year, I just rebuilt a boat. I destroyed my hands. They actually still hurt. 4 months of 15-hour days building an aluminum boat, like welding and grinding and cutting. Was this because of my dad, that I'm doing boats still, like he had the big boat dream at the end? Or was it my own failure? I blew like $60,000 on something that doesn't even work. It's an obviously idiotic design that anyone could have seen from the beginning was idiotic, but somehow I didn't see that and spent the 15-hour days doing it anyway. You know, and I've mentioned before that I didn't know why I married the woman I married. I mean, it was a great marriage for so long. I don't know why I couldn't stay with her forever. Like, I can't answer any of the big questions about my life. So I'm not just writing it, I'm also living it.
But I mean, do many people know? Can they explain their lives? It's only in fiction, really, where lives get explained. Isn't it?
Yeah, it was actually reassuring talking with you, like earlier. It's nice to hear your own life too, decisions that you wonder about. I mean, whenever you get close to someone and you like them and you get to hear what's going on in their life, like you find out, like, yeah, everyone else's life is kind of out of control too, which is why I think Greek tragedy has survived for 2,500 years. Like, essentially, that part hasn't changed.
Yeah, but I mean, your Greek tragedies are different because they're seen through landscape a lot, aren't they? Landscape is so important in all your books.
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's the big difference. Mm. In every other way, you could say my books are just like a play. They take place very close to dramatic unities, like Goat Mountain is just 2.5 days in one place with 4 or 5 characters and one consistent dramatic action that's followed through. You never get a break from that problem. And there's a taboo that's crossed. You know, the boy in that book kills a poacher hunting illegally on the land, like right away in the first chapter. Big problem when you like murder. Very hard for the other people in the family to deal with. So in all these different ways, it is Greek tragedy, but the primary difference is that it's all told through place, through description of the landscape. Landscape description, when I was in high school English classes, I thought it was an extra just put in there by authors for English classes so that you could talk about theme or talk about like
pantheism
in like To the Lighthouse, like yeah. Images of birds. I was pretty sure it was in there so we could write papers. But it turns out it's actually the lifeblood of the book. Like if you take away the descriptions of landscape, all of my books collapse and disappear. None of them make any sense anymore. That is where everything that matters can be found in the book. So the way they work is like a Rorschach test. So you smash ink on paper, you put ink on paper and then smash it. A psychologist does this too. You know you're in trouble if you see the ink paper thing, right? Someone thinks you need help. And of course, when you see it, because you need help, you don't say it's ink on paper. You're like, I don't know, it's kind of disturbing. It reminds me of when my grandfather would always make me eat catfish, you know? All the moments in all the books that describe the forest or the ocean, or even the sweater that my grandmother is wearing and the sweater my grandfather is wearing and the green beans on the pot and the stove, those can become a kind of landscape. Whenever they become crazy, whenever they don't make sense, and he imagines falling and having a birth vision with the clothing of his parents ruffling, like, and the green beans mixed in, whenever you get some odd vision, that's when the individual has changed their vision of the outside world to be a mirror for something that's inside. It's that simple. I mean, writing is so easy. All you need is two people who love each other and hurting each other in a place that's important to you so that when you describe it, it's going to become crazy and shift. Like, that's it. That's the recipe. So it's so simple. Like, and just make sure you don't know what you're doing. Like, don't have an idea. An idea is the worst thing that can happen to a writer. Like, just follow the characters of the problem and describe the place. Like, it's really my method. So it's part of it, as it turns out, it's part of a large, the largest American literary tradition is rural and regional and focused on the landscape. I love the publishing industry in New York. Like, they're the people who care about books and are keeping books alive. But they do have a little bit myopic view in thinking that the American fiction is urban, that it's set in the tri-state area, and especially in certain parts of New York City. And actually, that's not the American tradition. It's much longer and the larger tradition, and still the best writers that we have are focused on that landscape. And it's through that they get their vision. And we talked about on your TV show before, in Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, He talks about America as born in war and having a future of endless war. And it's all written through, all the vision, all the themes, all the things he has to say about America are in those descriptions of landscape and also violence as landscape in that book. Mm.
I wondered how the family reacted to Halibut on the Moon, and indeed all your writings about your father. How did they...
My uncle just doesn't read anything that I write.
Yeah.
So he's the closest character to my father in the book. It's my father with his brother throughout the book.
Gary is the brother in Halibut on the Moon. That's a reasonable portrait of your uncle?
That is a reasonable portrait of my uncle. Very accurate in details, and I'd be really worried doing that if I thought he would ever read it. But since I know he didn't read Legend of Suicide, and he won't read any of the books, it's safe. I can say whatever I want. It's all good.
His
wife has a book club, and it was so funny. So I love Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping, and it's set in Sandpoint, Idaho, right where my uncle lives. And so her ladies' book club read that book on my recommendation, and they all hated it for exactly the same reasons that the women in the town don't like the main characters in the book. It was so funny. It was like self-parody. I mean, they really said exactly the same things that the characters in the book say. And they'll only read, she read Aquarium because she heard it wasn't a tragedy, but she won't read any of the others. So I'm safe. I'm safe with the family.
You're safe.
But my stepmother, of course, reads everything. Yeah. My mother, my sister. My next novel is about my sister, and I'm going to get in big trouble because she does actually read it. She usually doesn't finish reading the books. She's not going to read this one, she said. She starts reading. She starts crying. She sometimes continues on, sometimes doesn't. And this one she decided not to read.
Were you relieved that she decided not to read it?
No, she could read this one. I just don't want her to read the next one.
Right. She wouldn't. I mean, she wouldn't be put off by Halibut on the Moon, I would have thought. But what about your mother and Nettie, your
You know, my mother wrote me the most beautiful note about Halibut on the Moon. She actually understood not only the book, like really what it's about for me, but what writing is about for me, why I do it. You know, writers are terrible for families. We expose all of our family's shame for people to read in 23 languages, like, and then go like talk about it on tour, like, oh, my family. I mean, it's not a great thing for a family. I mean, I do think if they didn't want to be written about, they could have behaved better, right? I mean, they had an earlier opportunity, but still, it's quite bad. And so to be understood by a parent where she is completely supportive and understands, that's really beautiful. I'm quite lucky. And especially after Dirt, my novel Dirt, which is about her family, like house and walnut orchard, and it has her name in the book is the name given to her by a favorite aunt, Susie Q, and it has that my grandfather beat my grandmother, and the favoritism and fights over money. I mean, exposed everything about my mother's childhood, even though everything in the book is made up, all the background and details are true. My mother actually forgave me for that too. And my aunt and cousin, who would never speak with me or meet with me again after that book, even my aunt has now come around and wrote me a beautiful note about this book. Yeah. And they really understand. So I feel quite lucky. And this should last for 2 more years until the book about my sister comes out. And then I know probably, I don't know, I'm running the risk again of they'll never talk to me again. So
What are you doing to your sister?
So you think maybe I could just like not publish the books or stop writing them. But each book that I've written has been the only book I could write at that time. I wasn't capable of writing anything else. I mean, that's been true every time. I never made a choice. Like each one, like that's all I could do.
But would you?
Sometimes I knew I was being bad, and I, like with Dirt, I knew it was really bad, and it was a guilty pleasure. I have to confess, I really liked being bad. Like every day, I was like, I shouldn't do this.
would you ever think, like with this next book, and I don't know what you're going to be doing, what you're writing about your sister, but clearly it's not good for her. Anyway, but would you ever sort of balance it up and think, well, it's just not worth it. I'm not going to publish it.
My sister who asked me this question. So we were at a family reunion, and Dirt had just come out, and she said, why did you publish it? If this is going to hurt Mom and expose her childhood, why would you do this? And I said, because I care about the books more than anything else. I care about the books more than I care about you, more than I care about Mom, more than I care about my wife at that time, Nancy, more than I care about myself, more than I care about what anyone thinks about me, any kind of sense of shame. It's just the truth. It's awful. I understand I'm a bad person, but it's all I care about, my life. That transformation of our ugly family stories into something that's beautiful and coherent and meaningful, instead of just being terrifying and meaningless like it was in real life, and like really the core of my real life is. Like my real life, I can't find a center to myself or my life, like, or a real purpose or sense of why I'm doing anything I'm doing. The one thing I can find is my substitute for religion, writing every day, and those transformations, discoveries, finding the beautiful, making something coherent, meaningful, like that's it. That's really it. And so it is what I'm going to do no matter what, even if I lose everyone. And it was awful to realize that, to have to say to my sister, I care about the books more than I care about you. It's not a great line for like for sibling like relationships.
What did she say next?
Not much.
But she still talks to
you. We get along really well. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
But, for the next couple of years
along,
anyway.
We got along fabulously our whole lives. We never fought. And then because she's had so much rage at having to raise twins alone with a husband who didn't help for the first 5 years, and because I skipped out, she thinks, on a marriage that was so easy, and she's staying in a really tough one, she was just filled with rage, and we had a screaming match this last summer and one 3 years before that. After the first one, I was so upset. I was really rattled. I hadn't had a screaming match with anyone in like a decade. But I thought, a book. Because I could only write about something, you know, that went terribly wrong. Like I've lived in New Zealand. I've been a resident for 15 years. I can't write about New Zealand because it's such a wonderful place, and I've had only a nice time there. There's absolutely nothing I have to say about New Zealand because all my time there's been beautiful. Like, and with my sister, it was like that too. She just didn't feature in a big way in any of the books, but suddenly...
Yeah. We'll open up for questions soon, so do, if you have some, there will be roving mics coming. But we might, I'll just carry on asking you a few questions. When Legend of the Suicide is, the main novel in here is framed with two or three other short pieces. In some editions of Halibut on the Moon, there's the same thing done. Mm-hmm. What are the other pieces doing?
So it was supposed to be framed by stories, just like Legend of the Suicide. Mm. But my American publisher didn't want that, so there's no English edition that has it. It's in the Dutch edition only is where you can find the stories. So if you happen to read Dutch, you can see what the other stories are. One of them is the Sheriff's Department Incident Report, the real report that has my writing around it. Crazy visions that my stepmother had at the time of getting the phone call and stuff, kind of spliced in with that. And it has, at the end, it has my uncle now. Very depressed, wondering about the shape of his life, having voted for Trump, have been converted to Catholicism by my aunt. It's about their grandchild, Ignatius, that's the title of it. And there's a story set that I really love, set in Lakeport, my grandmother having these visions where there's different death rituals. When someone dies in the town, the new burial rite is that their head is cut off and everyone throws it in the air twice and catches it and hands it to the next person. but there's so many deaths and it's such a long thing, everyone has to gather around. It's starting to become a like time and management problem. So there were some stories that give a different perspective on the book. And I really would have loved to have them in there. And I'm actually deeply disappointed that my American publisher was so like cowardly. And I only went with their version because they were going to dump me otherwise. But now they've dumped me anyway. And I really wish I had like had the stories in there and gone for the book that I wanted. Mm. So,
and I just I'd like to ask you what your view of gun culture is in the U.S. now.
Yeah. Well, you're going to get more positive talk. Yeah. You know, I just. I fought against the gun movement for a long time, our gun culture in the U.S., by writing the book about the school shooting and writing that our veterans from our American military are most often the shooters. I was doing radio interviews about that on Veterans Day, like around that time. It was not a super popular message. It turns out you can't really criticize the military in the U.S., and of course we're not going to have any reasonable gun control ever. In 2008, there was already a Supreme Court decision which made it impossible. And since then, all the efforts towards it are just token and political. They can't actually happen because the Supreme Court rules our country. 9 people rule the U.S. And now there's more conservative appointees put on the court by Trump. So for decades to come, you can't expect any change for guns in the U.S. or to the view of the military or race or many other like basic entrenched problems in the U.S. So that's why I left. I like New Zealand a lot better. So the gun thing, I mean, it's a long thing. 300 million privately owned firearms, 30,000 gun deaths a year, half of them suicide, 100,000 wounded. We're actually a war zone every year. In many states, it's legal to have served in the military, which is the number one risk factor. It must always be said, since it can't be said in the U.S. It's our soldiers who come back and kill us. Like, make no mistake, they're the ones they've been trained to kill without any emotional or psychological response. But you can have the military history and a mental health history where you're in an institution and a prison history where you're in prison because you learned lots of great things there and be drinking with a gun on your hip in a bar. That's legal because that seems safe.
So, yeah. Have you ever owned a gun?
Yeah, well, I grew up with guns. I mean, after my dad killed himself with a pistol when I was 13, my family thought it'd be a great idea to give me all of his guns. So I had a 300 Magnum rifle for bears. And of course, I shot out all the street lamps in our neighborhood from like 200 yards away, like blacked out the whole neighborhood. And I aimed at my neighbors. So they're having, you know, a cocktail in the evening. And I'm there with the crosshairs, with the shell in the chamber and the safety off. One little tap and they're dead. And not just dead, but like bear dead, you know, like gone, like crazy. And then I had a 30-30, like in the Westerns, you know, the rifle that is really fun. Killed my first 2 deer at 11. With that, like wounded one of them in the spine, so it's trying to crawl away and I have to go up and stick the barrel to the back of its head and execute it. Like, that's great for an 11-year-old to do. So yeah, I grew up with lots of guns, but now I don't have any guns. I think it's idiotic to think that you're safer with guns. Yeah. People think a gun in the home makes you safer in the U.S. Statistically, someone in the home commits suicide or has an accidental death with it. That's what actually happens. I'm even on a boat now in Langkawi, going to sail to the Philippines through the second hottest piracy zone in the world, and I'm not putting a gun on board. Because even in a situation with pirates, you're more likely to die if you come out with a gun, like the famous New Zealand sailor did in Venezuela. He ended up getting shot in the stomach after he came out with the gun. Mm. So the guns just don't make us safer. And unlike all the people who claim to be patriots in the U.S., I actually believe in law enforcement in the U.S., and I don't think my country wants to enslave me and the first step is to take away my guns. So I don't think I have to defend my life and property with my own gun. I think the police are actually reliable and will come and defend me. So, patriots.
Now, questions. There's a question down here.
As another transplanted Yank, much of what you say speaks to my heart. Mm-hmm. Brought up in a right-wing family in Alabama with guns in the cupboard. My question, though, is what do you think about writing as therapy? You are so sane. I mean, horrible stuff. I'm only here accidentally. But you're so full of good humor. You're so...
Oh, thanks.
Clear and clean, and it's what a jewel this has been.
Oh, thank you.
Do you think writing as therapy is needed, and do you think a lot of Yanks need to write?
Absolutely. I do think that all of the arts are therapy. I mean, after my dad died, I told everyone that he died of cancer because it was so shameful, the suicide. I couldn't say that it was suicide. And guns were my therapy. I just shot things every day. I had this double life. I was straight-A student, student body officer, and sports, and band. Everything seemed fine. Everyone thought I was an angel, and everything was fine. And then I aimed at them with the 300 Magnum at night and learned to break it in pieces in my jacket and cycle in the neighborhoods and shoot things. So I had this kind of double life, and it you'll be shocked to hear it wasn't effective as therapy. It didn't work well, the guns. But then I joined a drama group, and to get in, I had to audition. It was very hard to get into this drama group, and I had to tell the true story finally. I had to tell the true story that my father's death was actually suicide, not cancer. And it was the most tremendous relief just to speak that in front of a group of people and to be heard and have it be sympathetic. I've gone to therapy different times too. I didn't until I was like 21. I should have gone at 13. And that was really helpful. But all of the arts are wonderful as therapy because they give you a second chance and they let you reshape and reform that material into something coherent and meaningful. And alongside that, your life is being reshaped, alongside the material and the work. But it's different than therapy in that it has an aesthetic goal. You're trying to create the beautiful. So it's not just trying to understand your feelings and what happened and something closer to the truth of the relationships, but also trying to make something coherent and beautiful. And so that's how the arts go a bit beyond therapy, I think. And I find it more useful, more helpful. And I think that universally, like in every country I've been to, the arts work in this way. You know, I've had tours in 30 countries, and I was really shocked to find out that suicide bereavement is the same. You feel all the same things, whether you're in China, Norway, Turkey, here, like it's actually all the same. And how art works is the same kind of way too. How education works generally is similar. So there's such known quantities. We know it works. We know it makes us feel better. We know going to a therapist for most people who are depressed can help prevent suicide. Like, so it would just be great to have more funding and more direction and less shame around, you know, all these things. There's shame around being a writer. No, just kidding. Just around the suicide. But there's almost shame when you go in and you say you want to be a writer as a career path. It's almost like a shameful kind of decision, you know. Shouldn't you be doing something responsible? But anyway, yeah, I feel really grateful for feeling happy now. Like, my life is good. It's easy. I'm not suffering. And it's because of writing. And it's because of my mentor, John LaRue, who just passed away recently, giving me permission. I think in the arts, it kind of takes someone giving you permission to be able to do it also. Mm-hmm.
There was a question. There are two, the guy there and then a woman in front was also, yeah.
Oh, and sorry, I had one last thing to say. Sorry. Just because you mentioned America specifically, I actually, in America, it's really hard to get people to read tragedy. And there's this idea that books should make you feel good, and the characters should be really likable. And there's actually cases now in universities of students opting out of reading lists for courses if the books are going to be upsetting in some way. And Americans have missed, I think, the fact that writing and reading tragedy is actually refreshing and reassuring. To have to encounter your badness and failure and the things that are painful, you know, the darkest parts of your life, to spend a little bit of time with that in a safe space within a novel or writing a novel, something that's coherent and meaningful, that is tremendously refreshing. It makes you feel better for the rest of your day and the rest of your life. And I want Americans to understand that if we could be more honest about what our military has been and what role we've had in the world and the problems we've had around race and how we're insane about guns and lots of other problems, if we would more effectively face our problems in a national conversation and talk about our badness, that could lead toward us becoming better. And I think if we could stop being afraid of tragedy and not think that you have to feel good all the time and always be happy and just have books make you feel good, if we could have a different expectation of that and look back to 2,500 years of Western culture of how it viewed tragedy and how we, you know, face the full aspects of who we are, then I think America could be a better place. So I should have mentioned that part about it, because I think it is a particularly American problem, the relationship to tragedy.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Does it... We've only got a few minutes, so if you could keep them quick.
I just love that line, if you didn't want to be written about, you should have behaved better. It made me think of David Sedaris, and without knowing your work, maybe there's a bit of a link there somewhere.
I love him. Yeah, I met him at breakfast once in Amsterdam. There's one hotel that all the writers stay in, and they have all books from everybody signed. And he is just such a wonderful, generous, funny person in real life, too. I mean, he's just fantastic. I love, like, you know, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, if I'm getting the title right. It's so wonderful. You should definitely, don't get my book, because it might not make you feel good. Run out and get David Sedaris' book. Yeah, he's wonderful.
There's a lady there who's good.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for the tragedy part of your stories, because I actually think that what you said about the bleakness is ultimately really rewarding in your work. But I actually just wanted to ask you something about when you said that you, to your family, it's quite confronting to hear that you care about your books more than you care about them. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to challenge you a little bit about that, because what I hear you saying when you're writing about the aesthetics, when you take all the messy, ugly, difficult, sad parts of life, mm-hmm. but you don't package them up with a pink bow and give them back to us. You package them up with an aesthetic intent to actually and to draw something out from that is actually good. And you mentioned the note from your mother mm-hmm. and your aunt, mm-hmm. and that people have come to that perspective, your own family have come to that mm-hmm. perspective about your books. Mm-hmm. So does it have to be an either or?
No, I do think that these things that seemed awful things to do to my family, writing the books, ultimately became the pathway to healing and being closer. I had to write the rage and dirt where the boy screams at one point, like, "Are you my mother?" Like, after I felt like really thrown away by her. I had to write that before I could now have the great relationship I have with her now. Like, now we're planning all of our next trips together. Like, everywhere that she still wants to go and see, like, we're going to go. And I've spent, like, so many great times with her in the last, I don't know, was it 5 years or so. It's been fantastic. And it took two books. It took dirt, just saying all the rage and the fights we had. And then it took Aquarium about forgiveness, realizing how deeply I wanted to forgive her and be forgiven by her. And realizing that forgiveness was not undoing the past or even coming to terms with the various things that we did to each other, but instead just deciding that we missed each other now and we wanted to be a part of each other's lives still. You know, that we didn't want to be separate anymore and fighting. That was beautiful. And it's worked. It's amazing. All the therapy didn't work, but just deciding we missed each other worked. And now it's been great. So I do believe that tragedy helps us. And I believe that books, ultimately, everything in the arts is actually positive and does help people become more whole and have a chance to come back together. So I don't believe I'm doing a bad thing, actually. I do think that it's ultimately good, but it just doesn't seem like that, unfortunately.
Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time now, but you can do a good thing and go and buy some of David's books outside and get him to sign them afterwards. Meanwhile, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you all. Appreciate it. Thanks for the question.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.